Sheer Factor by Gary Davidson, an audiobook read by a guy doing an impression of Rusty the Rooster from The Friendly Giant. Chapter 1, The Keynote, August 2018.
Andy stood at the podium, gripping it tightly. Not quite as tightly as he did the arms of the dentist chair during a routine cleaning of his teeth, but tightly enough that his knuckles hurt. It had been a long, hard road to this moment. At each step, he'd faced a last-minute stumble or roadblock that should have resulted in failure. At each incident, he'd narrowly avoided yet another defeat. At each time, he'd made more enemies. What few knew is just how many times he'd been saved by friends. Well, not exactly friends. People who called themselves friends, but only helped knowing that each time, he racked up more debt to them. Andy tried to remember the Latin for what that was called. Was it quip pro bono? No, that wasn't right, but it was something like that, and since Andy didn't understand Latin, it didn't really matter. Before him in the Halifax Hall were 3,000 energized delegates of the party he now led. His winning the leadership had also been a close call. It had taken friends stuffing the ballots in his favor by some 7,049 votes. That seemed like an odd number, Andy thought. "It can't be even. That's suspicious," said the friend. "I gave Bernier 42 extra votes as well, just in case they investigate." They didn't investigate, because he hadn't asked them to, and he hadn't asked them because they didn't ask him if he wanted to. Waiting to be asked something was proving to be a rather successful way to dodge responsibilities Andy didn't want to have. But when it was discovered there were irregularities in the voting, they did ask him, and that time his response was, "I don't know, what do you guys think?" Andy had just been elected leader of the party when it was discovered by the ballot committee that 141,362 votes had been cast at a party convention that only 133,896 delegates had attended. The moment that was reported to him in the Executive Council, he froze in panic, not sure what he should do. The Executive Council considered what this would mean if it got out. It would call the entire leadership process into question. It would call Andy's legitimacy into question. Worse still, it would embolden the loser and sore sport Bernier into launching more attacks against them and their moderate policies. And as with any group that thinks they're the good guys, they decided it wasn't a big enough issue to worry about and voted not to investigate. "It's immaterial," said one. "We need a new leader, and we have one," said another. "Look at him. Does he look like the sort of person to cheat? He's a good Catholic family man, for Christ's sake. For the good of the party, for the good of the country, this can go no further." So they didn't investigate, and he didn't ask them to. And thank goodness, over 1,000 of the ballots had the same red mark made by clearly the same hand. Some even had the same red fingerprint on them. But that was then. This was now. Members of the party he led had gathered here in Halifax for a 3-day policy convention that was going to energize them for the next year's election. An election they were going to win. An election that would make Andy the Prime Minister of Canada. "International trade is a serious endeavor," Andy said to the people before him. The crowd applauded enthusiastically. Many rose to their feet. But on realizing they were the only ones doing that, that Andy wasn't finished, their applause died down and they sheepishly sat down again. "It's time for the grown-ups to be in charge again." More applause. "A revolt is brewing in Canada against Justin and his failed liberal policies. Hamish keeps telling him he can't repeat the word failure enough, so long as he links it to Justin or liberal each time, and that he repeat it over and over, even when he's tired of saying it." Andy felt it made him sound unoriginal, made him sound infatuated and shallow. He was shallow, but he didn't like sounding it. Hamish said it was branding, so he continued. "People are barely making ends meet. People are barely getting by. No one can get ahead, and now Justin wants everyone to pay a carbon tax? This crowd hates taxes. Never mind they pay for the roads they took to get here, the bridges that aren't crumbling like they do down south. Never mind every report Andy has ever seen indicates Canadian taxes are more well spent than in nearly any other nation on the planet. No one likes paying them, particularly not when they have a cottage mortgage, private school, boat, and an SUV to pay for. Particularly when they need the latest iPhone as soon as it comes out. The carbon tax isn't just bad for big business," Andy said. "It's bad for absolutely everyone. Which is why my first action when I'm Prime Minister will be to get rid of the tax once and for all." Killing tax is always good for votes. His party had cut the GST by 2% at a time when keeping that $9 billion a year would have made it a hell of a lot easier to balance the budget or pay down the debt. But they needed the votes in the 905 region around Toronto to form government. And you don't get those with social policies or sound fiscal ideas. You get them by promising to give the upper middle class more of their money back so they can spend it on Starbucks, not some single mother's sick kid. We can't keep robbing from our children, Andy said. The country's books are a mess caused by the deficit spending by this government. He knew that was a lie. His former boss had taken the $100 billion in debt payments the Chrétien Martin government had made during their 12 years in power and blew that and another $25 billion more in just 9 years on vanity projects and ridings they thought they could win. And he'd been part of that government, although mostly a silent part. And while his boss had increased the taxpayers' burden on the debt by 20 cents of every dollar, they had to do that in order to stay in power. The ends justify the means, right? And his boss had led Canada through 2 recessions and 3 economic stall periods, all while integrating Alberta-first policies into Canada's economy. And that sort of thing didn't come cheap. What else could they do? Most of their fundraising then and now was through private donors in the oil patch. It had to happen, or the money they needed to run attack campaigns against Liberals would dry up. And we need to stop pumping cheap fuel into the American economy. We need to get our resources to new markets, and we need to compete with other countries on taxation and regulation instead of rolling over. Andy was particularly pleased with that. Not just because it sounded like he wasn't a puppet of big oil, but because his former boss had signed a secret agreement with the Chinese that promised them oil and gave them the right to sue Canada through international tribunals if they failed to deliver. Boss was incredibly smart. He signed the FIPA deal because he knew that even if his conservatives were defeated by their liberals in the 2015 election, which they were, Canada would still have to put Alberta first or spend billions in fines and judgments. It was a win-win for Alberta oil, and all it cost was Canada's sovereignty. It was a win-win for conservatives because no matter what Justin did, they could attack him for it. I'm proud to say that we are the party of Canada's first prime minister, the father of our federation, and the visionary who made this land possible. Andy then said, I think it's a disgrace that we're allowing extreme voices in this country to erase our proud heritage. He liked calling the voices of inclusiveness extreme voices. That was another of Hamish's ideas, something he developed while running rebel media. Hamish was a true believer in anti-liberal thought. It was like a godless religion to him. The forces of political correctness are converging on contrary ideas and even on legitimate criticism, Hamish had said. And then he put that in Andy's speech. And after repeating Hamish's words, Andy continued with more of Hamish's additions. Attempts to remove statues and images of Sir John A. Macdonald, Canada's first prime minister, are a disgrace. Many other historical figures have ties to dark moments in Canadian history. We have legitimate concerns about immigration and who we're letting in. We have legitimate concerns that criminals, terrorists, and rapists, some very bad people, are jumping the queue for entry to Canada. We have concerns about the cost of these illegal immigrants, crossing where they're not supposed to and then claiming refugee status. But what does Justin say when confronted about these? He attacks those concerns by calling the tax-paying Canadians asking them racist and intolerant. Justin wants to impose his personal views on the country and demonize those who don't accept them. I vow to hold Justin Trudeau to account for smearing and name-calling those who criticize him. That got his biggest round of applause. Now the people who stood were joined by others, and he wasn't sure if it was because they all agreed Justin had horns in the service of Satan or just didn't like immigrants, but he put those concerns aside. He was the one they were applauding, and that felt good.